Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Tchibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffeegrande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Tchibo-Filiale und auf tchibo.de.
Welcome to another of those Conspiracy Guys True Crime episode. Today, we're talking about the original dog whisperer. Kss, don't murder. Kss. This guy is the 1970s most famous New York serial killer. He terrorized the entire island of Manhattan for over a year. 16 million people quaking in their boots, thinking that this cunt was going to jump out behind a building and shoot them. He says it was motivated by the spirit of a demon inside of his neighbor's dog. This time we're talking about the son of Sam, David Berkowitz. And joining me in the hot seat, all the way from England, via Squadcast FM, for all those podcasters out there, get on that shit, Squadcast. Streaming live on YouTube, we have the one and only Carol Donnelly. How are you doing, buddy?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me. This is exciting, it's Squadcast. I've never done one of these.
They're deadly, man. It's a really good app, and it's like not hashtag SP at all, bringing podcasters from across the world together. So hopefully we'll be able to do some more episodes together, and with some of our American cohorts as well. You're part of the All Things Comedy Network, along with Sam Tripoli and Ari Shaffir and these kind of guys.
Yeah, there's a bunch of good comics on that. I think we're one of the few British comics on it, There's a few Aussies on there, like Will Anderson and people like that. So yeah, they're starting to bring people in from around the world, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, bringing it all together, man. Podcasting is a worldwide thing. It's not your fucking backyard shit anymore. And what's your podcast called?
The one we got on All Things Comedy is the Carl or Chris podcast. So it used to be the Carl and Chris podcast when me and Chris Martin, my partner, lived in London together. Podcast partner. So I forgot the word partner could mean we were a
sure, that's okay.
Couple.
That's okay fine. Too.
It's absolutely fine. We're both married to women, so that would be difficult for them to learn. Imagine learning that on a podcast. But Chris
those
now.
Those conspiracy guys exclusive.
Chris now actually lives in LA. But so we still do the podcast as it's ours, but we've split it. So we do them individually. I do them with guests in London. He does them with guests in LA.
Of course, Chris Martin, like he had to go there after he was married to Gwyneth Paltrow and Coldplay got really big. So he just moved to LA. Like, is that?
Yeah. Well, the amount of grief he gets online, he gets about, I reckon, 2-3 messages a day on Instagram or Twitter from somebody from India or China who just thinks he's Chris Martin, because he does actually look a bit like him as well.
I'd play that up, man. I'd be like, let's lean back into that shit and use it as an Instagram marketing strategy. Like, why the fuck not? Do you know? I'm going to be going on the whole Jonah Hill, Seth Rogen thing as soon as I get over there. Have to be a little bit more dewy, I guess. A little bit, just wind that up a little bit. Be a bit more like...
Is that a technical term?
I think that's the proper adjective. And on your podcast, you interview comedians, you talk about comedy, and you talk about
over the years, comedy has become less and less of a discussion point. No, we just talk about all sorts. I just told you about how recently we had one where I had to edit a chunk out because we said something about somebody we thought was a well-known secret. And it was like an open secret, but it turns out it was a legal secret. So.
Like a proper secret.
It was a real risk. I mean, it was a massive secret. I wish I could say it, but yeah, we talked about a comedian who had a criminal past that we thought was well known. Turns out he hadn't.
Yeah, we talk about this kind of stuff all the time. Skirt the I guess the borders of legality. And when we had one episode on Sandy Hook, and then I saw what was going on with Alex Jones, it was squeaky bum time for a while, Carol. Yeah. I have to admit. Like, I mean, what you say on a podcast, I suppose, can be deleted, but what you say on Twitter is screenshotted and can be held in evidence against you. Lord of Mercy on James Gunn and the Guardians of the Galaxy 3. It's the end of that shit. Everyone is now frantically going back to their Twitter, just like deleting everything.
Oh, I wouldn't even be bothered to scan back. I'll just accept that I've probably said something that will get me fired from some job at some point. I'm already just coming to terms with losing whatever job it is that I lose. I'd rather do that than spend 2 days going back through Twitter.
You feel freer. It's just like, it's like a social media Russian roulette, right?
Exactly. Let's not dwell on the past. Let's just scared about the future.
That's the way it always is for us. When's the next fucking paycheck? So you were a comedian as well. You're going to be going to Edinburgh.
The Fringe. By the time this goes out, it will probably have started. It starts very start of August, goes through to the end. And yeah, I'm doing it it's the 12th year in a row I'm doing it. I've done it since I started out. I'm brand new. Savage. I know, I've not had a... It's my dear, so I've, technically by the end of this festival, I've spent over a year in Edinburgh, the city, which is weird.
At the doing the festival, which is no mean feat either. It's a test of mental and physical endurance, like drinking White Lightning, eating deep fried foods, staying up all night, like doing rails of cocaine.
It really takes it out of you physically, actually. I mean, I've got better over the last couple of years. When I was quite new to comedy, I treated it as a lad's holiday. We used to refer to it as Ladinburgh, which is really horrible. But it's just because we were all like mid-20s, just in a bit.
But you're able in your mid-20s, man. You could drink all day, have loads of fucking kebabs at nighttime, wake up in the morning, shit a shovel handle, and then get out and just flyer all afternoon and do comedy that night sugary cider and mild cocaine.
And a Diet Coke when you woke up just managed to just get rid of any hangover. I don't know how, but now I went
my girlfriend calls Diet Coke a black ambulance for the hangover. That's what it is.
It's nice.
Yeah, it's good.
But I'm still recovering from a stag do I went on 3 weeks ago. That's where we're at now. It was 4 days fully old school drinking, and I can't. My body did not forgive me.
You're like Doctor Who with a regeneration, just going like, all the sun coming out of you, going, please, I'd swap a body just to have all my social capital from making this face famous. I'll just get rid of it just to have to feel okay again. We're talking about the Son of Sam. Before we go on into that, where can people find you? Where's your website? Where's your social? Because they're obviously going to love you.
I am on Twitter, Instagram. It's all at Carl Donnelly, which is just CarlDonnelly. Website's carldonnelly.co.uk. And if anyone's at the Fringe, I'm doing a show at the Counting House at 6:45 every night called Strictly Carl Donnelly. It's a terrible pun. That sort
are
of
you,
works.
Are you on the actually, front like this in one of these like?
My poster is based on the poster for the film Superfly. Just because.
Oh, brilliant!
Yeah, it's actually a really nice. It's a nicely designed poster, a version of Superfly, but in it, we've shrunk my head down a bit just to be a bit creepy.
But Edinburgh poster game is on fleek at the moment. The Photoshop levels are up.
I take part responsibility for that. About 5 years ago, my friend who's a graphic designer, we started doing really silly but really well designed posters, and then everyone started, everyone's got a bit more professional about it.
Yeah,
exactly. And now there's a poster awards every year, and I'm saying that I caused all that.
They'll give you a slice of the Perrier just for that shit, I think.
They should.
All of those links that Karen mentioned are all going to be in the description below, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on your podcasty earbox. Check out the description of the episode and click through for some Donnelly laughs. So Son of Sam, this lad is one of the weirdest, most egotistical, narcissistic, but simultaneously shame-filled, guilt-ridden, I'll use the word again, Jewy. You know, he has this whole like Jewish mother, oppressive yet still, intrinsically linked to his identity and his ability to be able to love himself or not feel shit about every single thing he's done in his life. And I think that's what Jewish people and Irish people definitely have in common. There's this Irish mammy syndrome. You're half Irish, aren't you, Cal?
Yeah, my mum's Irish, yeah, so I grew up, I've also been a serial killer since I was 12.
that's the crime that we weren't allowed to talk about on the podcast. It's
I forgot it was all about me.
There's so many revelations here. You have a partner, he's in Coldplay, you're a serial killer. Fucking hell. This is going to be played back in a courtroom someplace at some point. So Irish people and Jewish people have that kind of Irish mammy thing where it's like oppressive, but like very loving as well. And it's, you know,
yeah.
I'm also in your business, but I just want you to do well.
Yeah. But I don't just think it's the mothers that do it. I do think it's, people talk about the English stiff upper lip, and having grown up in England, but with, you know, from an Irish family, I think the Irish is way worse. Like, I think, yeah, the inability to let any emotion out. I think it's probably getting better generationally now, but I do think, you know, I look at my parents and, I've, you know, their emotional capacity is really shit. And I think, you know, I think there is probably a similar, that's probably from Irish Catholicism, maybe. And that's maybe just where that's why Jewish people have it as well. It's quite a sort of, guilty, you know, religion. It's a guilt-ridden, yeah.
Life. So you have the worst of both. So you have like the unemotional stiff upper lip of the English, and then you also have the emotional guilt for any thoughts you may have. So you're like,
yeah,
you're fucked, double fucked.
Yeah, I mean that's why I've had to go off and learn how to do things like meditation, and that's how I don't end up actually losing my mind. You know, my brother's into like, he's a flat earther and stuff, which, you know, is. It's fascinating. It's not for me. I don't believe it. But like, you know, I think that must come from the fact our parents weren't particularly giving with information and love, that he's had to look elsewhere for the answers.
It's just a way to cope. You know what I mean? He's looking somewhere else, trying to find a reason why he never went on a holiday as a child. He's like, Mom, I didn't bring me on holiday because the earth is flat.
We had to go to the west of Ireland for our whole summer holidays every year. It was shit and it rained. Yeah. So I think now he's convinced the rest of the world doesn't exist.
Like, that's Australia. What I mean, yeah. He never went to Australia, so he just was like, nah, my mum and dad weren't like cheap and mean and unemotional. The earth is flat. It's the best way to decide.
I hope he doesn't hear this. I'm not having a go.
No, just we've just finished a Flat Earth episode, like I recorded a couple of days ago, and it should be out now as well.
Oh, cool.
Like, you know, I will talk about it another day. This is Son of Sam. Crazy shit, but good crack. So Sam has this, or David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, has this disassociative kind of attitude towards women, towards the maternal thing. And always with these fucking guys, it's always something weird with the mother. Do you know, looking at Andrei Chikatilo, who was a Russian serial killer, his ma used to bring him out and get him to stretch his dick out, and she'd bait it with a bit of bamboo, like, you bald, dirty boy, like whipping his cock, and you're like, what are you going to expect him to do with that later on? It's not stopping him pissing the bed. Loads of them, like, there's all something weird. So this whole thing with David Berkowitz started because of his weird family issues, and I didn't know any of this stuff coming up. So what did you know about Son of Sam? Like, what was in the zeitgeist?
Well, I'll tell you the two things. One was most of it I knew from the film Summer of Sam, the Spike Lee film. That's sort of where the idea of what actually happened came into my mind. And then in terms of just from, you know, out in the ether, the things you hear about these stories, I always got this mixed up quite often with the Zodiac Killer.
Yeah.
Because they're really similar, you know, to the point that I think... that's what I know. I have watched the odd weird documentary where this guy was interviewed, and you know, he's referenced certain like sort of satanic things, and there's a few conspiracies I know knocking around that actually him and Zodiac were linked, and it was all, you know, linked to Manson and all that. You know,
it's part of an ongoing satanic serial killer agreement or something. Yeah.
So I'd heard that. So I knew that little part of it, and I knew, you know, from the film Summer of Sam, just how scary it was for people in those suburbs in New York that were being affected. You know, it was a real, like, you know, batten down the hatches, scared to go out sort of, you know, sub, wasn't it?
The movie kind of puts that thing in where it's like New York was terrorized by the fear of murder in a very closed-in space that has millions of people in it.
Yeah.
That anywhere you go at any point, someone could come out and shoot you. And I think it was... a reflection of like the general malaise in New York at the time. Because like we'd forget, you know. Did you watch The Get Down? Did you watch that? It's like the,
no.
There's like a, it's a drama on Netflix, like a comedy musical drama, which is a bit of a stretch. But it's called The Get Down, and it's kind of the origins of hip-hop in New York in the mid to late 70s and early 80s. And it talks about, you know, MC Kool Herc, and it talks about, what those other guys? I can't even remember the names now. It had some scenes of New York that looked really sketch, and there's like this, there's political undertones where they're talking about, like, you know, businessmen were coming in and buying up slums and areas that were really run down. That were predominantly African American populated, and you know, taking people for everything they got, building massive high rises, and then charging loads of money, and then putting people out of their homes, sending them out to the suburbs. And it was like a gentrification of downtown New York. So, like, at the time, you know, like the Warriors, you know, this kind of shit was going on. Like, there was gangs roaming the place, and it was. It's been dramatized since, and probably if anyone from New York is listening, you're like, you're not describing that right at all, but. I mean, like, it was a time of fear generally, where you couldn't go out at night time. There was some shit going on, like taxi driver shit. Like, you're, you know, as David Berkowitz says himself, like, the streets smell like piss and blood and vomit. And, you know, it was a rough place to be at the best of times. And now you have fucking some disaffected Jewish kid who just took it upon himself to go out and start executing people. Seemingly without, you know, any kind of discrimination. There wasn't a motive. It was just fucking fear. And I knew that from the movie, but I'd watched the documentaries a long time ago. And I never realized, you know, the way you hear, like, oh, yeah, he was told by the dog to do it. And that was.
No, I never knew any of that sort of stuff. I knew there was rough, not, you know, it wasn't like an exact victim description, but.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I've heard some theories on it that. He like, because a couple of the guys who were involved, you know, when it was like a couple in a car, the guys had long hair. So there's a few, I know the police.
Like it was girls or something,
Because some of the other ones he obviously attacked were two girls alone. So there's a theory, I think, that he was going for, you know, and that again ties in with the whole mother thing of, you know, if you're going for a certain type of young woman, I think. Somebody's got some mummy issues.
Yeah, his mammy was of the same sort, and he was like, I want to kill you to get revenge. Yeah. It seems like, for me, as a young child, I remember hearing about Son of Sam, and it was like a demonic possessed dog. He was like schizophrenic or something like that, and he was told by the dog to kill these people. And I was like, yeah, I get it. It's just a crazy guy. And as we'll learn later on, it wasn't that he was so crazy. It was that he knew to say that to maybe... garner like maybe public sympathy, or because I never saw the videos of him roaring, laughing and smiling, giving evidence in court, being like, yeah, and then I shot her. Like, it was like, you know, you won a fucking ribbon at sports day. He was so happy just to be having someone listen to him and get a bit of attention. And now with my 30 something cynicism hat on, I'm like, this cunt is, there's a lot, like, the crazy runs deep.
Yeah, but what do you suspect he was putting a lot of it on just to build a sort of a character?
Yeah, well, as we'll find out now, like, we'll go through his past more so as well. I like to do on these true crime episodes and kind of figure out, like, because, you know, you get torture porn and you get these fucking, and he stood over there, his chest heaving with a bloody knife as he carved her breasts, and you're like, yeah. But why though? Why was he doing that?
So we like to
look at those kind of things here and try and figure it out. And it's nearly always the mother. Chalk it down.
Yeah.
To get into it then, David Richard Berkowitz, born on the 1st of June 1953, and was adopted just 3 days after his birth to the Berkowitz family, Nathan and Pearl Berkowitz, who were, you know, a Jewish-American couple living in the Bronx. They had no children, and they owned a hardware store, and they just wanted to start a family and you know, bring up a kid. And they ended up, like, rolling snake eyes in the old adoption agency.
I know, but it's already a big enough risk, I think, having kids. Even, like, I'm not saying if they're going to be a murderer, but just I always think, how bad must it be to have a child, raise them, and then they turn out to be an asshole? Do you know what I mean? That sort of.
And they're not even about, yours, so you're like, you can't even go, so like, yeah. Like,
oh, we bloody got a free arsehole down there.
Do we keep the receipt? I don't know. Do you know what happened, though? It was a weird phenomenon. The kids that were getting adopted from Romanian orphanages all through the 90s. Did you hear what happened to those kids as they grew up?
No.
So because they were so, I guess, neglected through the Ceausescu regime, there was these orphanages in Romania and even in Moldova that were full of babies that had no communication skills, even to the age of 5 or 6. They had like bone problems and growth problems, hormone deficiencies as they hit puberty, and brain underdevelopment, because they were just basically born, put in a fucking cot, maybe 3 or 4 in a cot, like an overfilled burrito. And then they were just given, like, you know, cow and gate sloppy baby food, just so that they wouldn't die. And then you see them and they get like whatever, like, you know, no education, no interaction, no stimulation, no play. There was no kind of, you know, love or any of that stuff given to them. And then at 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7, or even as early as like 1.5 or 2. So like that first 6 to 8 months is like super important for cognitive development and all that kind of stuff. And you have to be able to like recognize shapes and colors, and the language center start to build. And they got none of that. And then they were adopted out. And then when all these kids started hitting puberty, they went into like psycho mode. They went into like, you know, sexual deviancy, masturbating in public, exposing themselves, playing with feces, started going into like screaming fits, started showing signs of schizophrenia and all this kind of stuff because of these early developmental traumas. So like you can see that this whole thing for Berkowitz could definitely, even as mild as it was, as being like adopted, but he was told, you know, his dad used to work 6 days a week. He rarely saw his father. His mother would give him, you know, some attention, but was still a little bit like distant. Obviously didn't give him everything he wanted. And there was that kind of, you know, malaise in the household. And early in his life, he was told that he was adopted and that his mother died in childbirth, like real early.
Yeah. And so have you ever heard that theory about the crime drop in America in the 90s? Sorry, in New York in particular. So, you know, you're saying about how, you know, that sort of how dangerous it was. And, you know, and then obviously in the 90s, there was a zero tolerance policy policing. Yes.
Yeah.
And so that sort of was, what was the mayor at the time? Was it Giuliani? No, it wasn't Bloomberg then, was it? But basically they take credit for it, saying it was zero tolerance that just totally, you know, dropped crime down to an incredibly low level in comparison. There's a theory.
There's a cop on every corner.
Yeah, but there's a really interesting theory that talks about the age of sort of, you know, most criminals when they get into criminal activity. If you sort of trace it back and look at when abortion was legalized, it basically, they reckon there's a theory that the people that basically wouldn't have been able to get an abortion from very low income, difficult situations, would have had those kids. They would have been raised in a situation that had much more chance of them going into crime. So it basically just making abortion illegal wiped out a generation of potential criminals.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's some great articles about it. It's really fascinating. And that sort of talks about it. So you look at New York, essentially, it was an area where, you know, abortion was quite heavily used by the socioeconomic group that would have been most likely to go on to become criminals. It's crazy, but it's a really interesting one.
That's a like, crazy contentious point. I get.
Oh yeah, I just saw. Look at this.
Rudy Giuliani was the zero tolerance guy, but the abortion thing. Like, think about the people that are living in New York. Like, you've got Italians, you've got Jews, you've got Irish, very religious, very devout, and obviously a lot of them wouldn't be up for abortion. And Roe v. Wade coming in changed a lot of that. Do you think that in a few years' time to be a lot less criminal activity in Ireland now that, you know, the abortion referendum has passed over the last little while?
Is there a lot of crime?
I mean, there's a lot of not
Limerick gangs I've heard about.
Ah, no, they're not really. They're, you know,
shooting each other in the town square every 2 days.
Yeah, I think there's a different type of cleansing needed for that type of thing. But no, I think for the, like, there's a social problem here in Ireland at the moment with like young people that are special needs. They have like underdeveloped home lives that they end up having to go into social care. There's a lot of stuff here with a lot of kids. Like, they're not turning into serial killers. They're not fucking you know, crazy social outcasts, or they're not fucking deviants or anything. But there's a lot of people who are not living their best life and not able to ride up to a certain age. And a lot of people are saying, like, yeah, but they should still get the chance at life. And I'm like, yeah, but if you've a load of people on heroin and they're just like banging out the kids, and then social services are coming and taking the kids off them, surely they shouldn't be allowed to be having those kids. It's not, you know.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. What's the there's no real solution that doesn't get into, you know, some sort of
eugenics program. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's a slippery slope, I think.
That's where we're going.
This whole New York one that I read is much more of an accidental or side effect of something. And it's not, it was just, it's one theory that I've read two articles about that I found it an interesting opinion, but it could ultimately be total bollocks, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm going to go look into it further now that you mentioned it. Like, I just saw there's the consequences of zero tolerance. There's a few articles up there. So I am going to go look. But cool. It does sound like an accidental experiment that's shown a positive case.
Exactly. Sometimes, see, you know, what happens. Positives come out of negatives.
No, yeah, exactly.
Negative.
But for David, he got that trauma being told very early that he was adopted. And, I mean, imagine being told that you killed your mother in childbirth at like five, when you just realizing
what
that
age
is.
He was
around four or five
when they told him.
That's what I was reading. Yeah, maybe I'm wrong. Ooh, but
see, that's a bit young, isn't it? Let him get to 11 or something.
He was being bullied in school, you see, because it was found out that he was adopted, and there were, you know, he treated his parents real poorly for the time after he found out the news, and he'd act out and try and get his mother's attention and be throwing plates and, you know, like, not smearing shit on the walls, but everything. But, and his dad wasn't there. His dad worked 7 days a week. So like he didn't have any support for this whole time. And then when he was in school, he was, you know, he was becoming a bully to the people he could bully.
Yeah. I heard the word arson thrown around about him in his teens.
He was a fire.
That's always a bad sign.
It's arson, setting small fires and killing small animals. They're the
animals. Yeah, they absolutely, yeah.
So if you see him choking his chicken, like, make sure call somebody. And they tried. They brought him to a psychotherapist. Consulted a psychotherapist and said, "Look, this behavior is unacceptable," but it never, you know, resulted in any repercussions or recrimination, even though he was doing small, like, petty misdemeanors that should have been watched, but weren't. And then the bullies in school were going, like, he's not a real boy. And in all the documentaries I watched looking up for this, all of them mentioned this, like, Pinocchio syndrome, where he felt that he wasn't legitimate. Like, being given up for adoption, possibly, you know, because he was a bastard child. He's already had rejection from his original mother, and now he's not getting the attention from his father, who's out at work. So it's like all this rejection, shame, guilt, all funneled into this one kid before he's even left school. Like, that's bananas. What do you think about the Pinocchio syndrome thing?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting one. I've never heard that phrase before. It's it makes sense, I think. I mean, there must be. I know people that are adopted, and I think it differs from person to person. I know some people that adopted who genuinely couldn't give a shit. I know it sounds mad because it's such a big thing, but I think they just have that weird capacity to not care about where they come from. And I think some people just have the opposite. Some people obsess about it. You know, I mean, I've done it. I'm quite prone to, you know, just looking at, not so much anymore, but I used to be really negative about my childhood, and I was constantly looking back, trying to work out why I was the way I was. And actually, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you keep obsessing about where you're from, you're going to ultimately stress yourself out, aren't you? Make it worse. Whereas,
well, you're occluding your future and wrecking your present by worrying about the stuff in the past, you know?
Exactly.
So and then all of a sudden, your present becomes looking back in the past, and your future is like forever then destined to be looking back. I think comedy is a great way to get away from that sort of stuff, and I find a lot of comedians would be broken people, let's say.
Murderers. Something would be shooting people in parked cars.
I mean, like, a few bad jokes is not as serious as shooting.
I definitely think it, and also, if you're the sort of person who didn't get enough attention when you were a child, aka me, I do think getting it off a room of strangers, and even if sometimes you don't get it fully off a room of strangers at a bad gig, I do think it must, I reckon there must be some empty part of me that I need to fill with the what I deem the love of strangers, because I didn't feel like I got enough of it from my parents.
Yeah, it's weird. You want to watch
the next Son of Sam should have become a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he was in New York in the late 70s. Oh. He could have been a Lenny Bruce, you know. Like, he just missed his call.
He could have got in just before the sort of Seinfeld boom.
Yeah. Dead. Yeah, I think, what's with all of these people dying in cars?
Hey, have you heard about
comedians
this?
Comedians in cars getting shot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fucked up, man. It's fucked up.
I know.
Like, the attention and learning all of that stuff, like, could really fuck with your head. So he was so desperate for his mother's attention, get this one, that he killed her pet parakeet. Did you hear about this shit?
You heard about this? So this guy.
I mean, terrible. I mean, killing animals is always a sign. Well, killing your mum's pets, that is, there's definitely levels of, like, killing a, you know, a weird stray cat in the area is bad. And I, you know, I think it's horrible, but.
Killing a squirrel is like, yeah, it's pest control.
Yeah, but actually killing your mother's pet, that if ever there's a sign that you're looking for her attention, you know, that's about as big a one as you can give her, isn't it?
It was alleged that, like, she used to talk to the pigeon, ooh, let me out, will you? Talk to
Sounds
the parakeet.
Like a euphemism for someone else, isn't it? Yeah. She's off talking to the pigeon, mate.
It was a pet that she used to talk to and give it attention. And little David is looking there going, she never talks to me like that. And then just one day Polly got a cracker, you know, and that was the end of it.
Do we know how he did the deed or not?
I really hope it's like he just like smothered it or broke its neck. Like, he didn't finger it to death or anything weird like that.
I hope it was as, you know, pain-free as possible for the poor pigeon.
Yeah, vegans.
Exactly.
another incident that shows David's, I guess, disdain and simultaneous, like, yearning for his mother's love and disdain for, I guess, not fulfilling everything that he wanted, was one day, and you can imagine then the compounded guilt, Carl, from this. One day they were having a big fight and he screamed at her, "I hate you, I hope you die." And then she went out for that night, out to dinner, and she collapsed at dinner, and she died.
That is... See, that sounds not true.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Does it not sound a little bit like that could be an exaggeration on what happened?
Yeah. She had breast cancer.
I mean, that's not an exaggeration. But, I mean, the time scale of that could have been... He could have shouted it, and a week later she died.
Exactly, but it's really nice for a true crime kind of documentary to be like. And then he said, "I hate you, I hope you die," that evening. Dun, dun, dun. Like, it doesn't. So,
but even if you said that once,
yeah,
and 10 years later your mum dies, you're in your guilt going to think, well, I caused that.
Of course. But it was just so happens that that night, she was hiding breast cancer from the entire family. So again,
family, she hadn't even told the dad.
No, lies, deceit, this stuff. She'd hidden breast cancer from the whole family, went into a coma that night and survived for a time. Like you said, it's probably, you know, it's more dramatic to say, like, immediately exploded from cancer. And she was out in a restaurant, took a bad turn, went into a coma and died sometime later. And he carried that guilt around. Obviously,
well, and to him, now he thinks he's killed two mums. That is, he's essentially a mum serial killer already.
Yeah, mummicide. He was on. Hey, I'm Jablowski from Mummicide. These guys, would you like a pie? No, these guys are like, he's killed two people, so you can box off in your head how he can then justify killing more people later on.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's killed the two most important people in his life, essentially. So, yeah, absolutely. You could understand that to him, these strangers later in life who would represent you know, maybe his first mum, you know, his birth mum. Yeah, you could see that maybe their lives in his mind didn't mean as much as the two people he'd killed accidentally.
Yeah, it's fucked.
Well, yeah, it is.
He grew up his whole adolescence then, no mum. His dad was very distant, working all the time, and just wanted him just to be a functional human, just fuck off, leave me alone. A lot of dads were like that at the time, 70s, 80s. We watched The Wonder Years, and we know the crack. It's just like, and then like reluctantly give you some kind of, you know, an emotional connection like once a year instead of a Christmas present or whatever. So at 17, David Berkowitz is like, fuck this. I want to die for my country. I want to die, first of all, I think was probably the main motivation.
Yeah.
I may be wrong. And second of all, he's like, I want to die as a patriot for America. I want to join the army and die in Vietnam. Because he, like, at the time, you're talking, Vietnam is all over the TV, a lot of, you know, protests against it, and then a lot of, obviously, patriotism. You're talking Johnson, Nixon, the whole thing is being promoted to a certain demographic who will, as with any war, go out and fight for their country to be, you know, a little bit of a hero, support, you know, I'm all about the troops, man. Like, you do what you want. It's the armies. It's the attacks on the country. Like, the people who are in the armies are just doing their job. And this guy wanted to do that.
Do you also think he was looking for, say, yeah, even though this is just getting into the psychology of it, about, you know, if his a distant father didn't really give him a lot of advice, maybe a lot of guidance, looking for a very male-centric, you know, sort of hierarchical system to enter, where he's going to get bossed around by a big strong guy.
He needs control. He needs a father figure. He needs companionship. He needs fraternity and brotherhood and belonging that the likes of the army or the Freemasons or, you know, your local lodge or, you know, the comedy community. Oh, that's a joke. They're absolutely not supportive. But, you know, these it's like some weird anti-masonry guys. It's all like, give me a secret handshake and I'll tell you you're a prick. So it just seems that, like, he wanted to move into that structure and also die because he was like, fuck this. Horrifically depressed. And later on, he go through bouts of mania and depression, probably because of some, like, personality disorder, some kind of borderline thing. And he went to join the army, and they sent him to Korea instead.
Yeah, that is, that's a bad, you know, if you're looking to die in a blaze of glory.
Yeah. Or kill a load of people in a blaze of glory. He wanted to go to Vietnam and kill indiscriminately, as some did. And he ended up getting sent to Korea, which wasn't in conflict at the time, and it was just maybe like peacekeeping stuff. And he was like, bollocks. So he trained. He ended up becoming a marksman for the army with an M16 rifle. So he was like a good shot.
Yeah.
And the whole time he was there, he's like, I thought I was going to be coming over here to kill Vietnamese and then die in a blaze of glory. And he started writing letters to his dad, and this was like his emotional outcry. He felt so far away. He didn't get what he wanted. And he was writing letters to his dad saying he felt illegitimate. He felt broken. He felt ugly. He used to call himself De Schmutz, which is like Yiddish for the disgusting one, or one who is disgusting. So he was this whole, you know, the self-loathing, and it comes with like that whole kind of Irish Jewish kind of, you know, the way I don't know if you knew Irish, if your ma taught you any Irish, but like the Irish for masturbation translates into English as self-pollution,
right?
So you're literally polluting yourself if you touch your money. So it's all of this guilt.
It's the opposite. It's sort of cleaning out the pipes.
I think it's a cleansing thing.
But I like that. Just having a
medicinal
name
almost.
That it almost feels like he was already starting to create a character, you know, around himself. You know, create the sort of myth that maybe he didn't even realize he was doing it. But obviously, he's manic and he's.
Yeah, I think he's 18. When you're manic like that, like I go through phases of mania and depression, like reasonably mild, but I know that as that levels up, you do end up going into like massive false realities and creating like alternate memories of history, and you change your past and you tell massive lies, and it ends up bigger and bigger and bigger. So yeah, maybe he was not planning to kill then, but like inadvertently creating
the monster.
Yeah. Maybe the monster was there. He was just finding the monster. Do you know?
Well, that's it, yeah. Yeah, I never know. It might be in split personality or something. Yeah, it was. There's a lot of... We don't know. We're,
no.
You know, sort of weekend psychologists, really.
Yeah. Armchair. It's happening. We're
a few psychology books. Now let's talk for an hour about our theories on this man's mental health.
Yes, I've heard a podcast or two about mental health. The army didn't like him. Didn't want him. He was a bald pup. He was discharged, honorably, but discharged for discipline problems. He wasn't following orders. He wasn't getting up in the morning. He wasn't doing right. He was having personal problems with his army mates. And the family that he went in looking for, he didn't really find. The fraternity he didn't get. And he ended up coming back to New York. And then, you know, he blames, later on in Berkowitz, in interviews, blames this period of his life and the fact that all through his teenage and even like, you know, late childhood, like 8, 9, 10, he was watching horror movies on TV because he was left at home a lot on his own and watching these horror films. And he blames that for the influence on his behavior and possibly the reasons behind his killing spree, watching stuff like, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And it's the same as we learned from our Ted Bundy episode of, like, Ted Bundy in his last interviews blamed pornography for his crazily disgusting sexual acts, like having sex with dead bodies and like killing someone, raping them, burying them, going back later on, digging up the body and having sex with like the decomposing body. Like all of that stuff he blames on watching too much porn. And I think it was just a handy thing because at the time...
Well, it's the chicken and egg thing really, isn't it?
Like, but society at the time was... hammering porn into submission. They were, because it was coming out on VCR at the time and it was much more prolific, and there was movements in government against pornography, and Ted Bundy went like, okay, I'll jump on that. Like he was clever. Like,
yeah.
So I think maybe later on this is a retconning from Berkowitz to say,
it
was like scary movies.
Yeah, and I'm a massive horror fan, so I watched a lot of them from a very young age. Having an older brother meant I could. You know, he'd get them for me and stuff. And yeah, I can safely say it didn't turn me into a psycho killer.
Yeah, but it polluted your mind a little bit, like changed you into...
Oh, yeah. I mean, but I still love horror films. I still get scared of them. Like, I see them for what they are. They are a fantasy of...
Sure.
You know, I like being scared. I like the feeling of being scared. I don't take any joy in watching something horrible happen in them. I find that actually really terrifying. That's why I love them. They almost take me back to being a 12-year-old.
That's the thing. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for that, like that fright. And I think some of the modern horror movies are maybe looking into more the psychological and more the deep and dark. Yeah. It's gone from this slasher gore, like jump scare stuff, into more psychological horror. But at the time, it was as graphic as it could be. Like when you're seeing somebody getting their head chopped off in a movie, that's like, I've never seen that shit before. Now you can go on YouTube and watch 100 of it in real life. Like, you know, it's just... at the time, it kind of fucked him up. So after he came back from Korea, he found out from his dad, from Nathan, that his mother was alive after all. Can you imagine that shit? His original ma was alive after all.
Did I read somewhere that he was discharged from the army as well?
Yeah, he got honorably discharged for...
honorably.
Honorably.
What's that mean? I know dishonorably is like get back out. What's honorably? How can you be honorably discharged?
That you can say that you were part of the, you know, you can wear your medals, you can wear a uniform, you can attend like Veterans Association stuff, you can get benefits like ex-veteran.
Like redundancy benefits. Rather than being fired.
Exactly, yeah. Right, so honorably discharged.
So even then he's being pushed rather than...
Yeah, well, so he's been abandoned essentially issues.
Again by another family.
Exactly. And then he went into this. He came home feeling fucking dejected. He's like not even 20 yet. He's going to these adoption child groups. So if you were an adopted child, it's like an AA meeting, and you go sit around and go like, "I feel like I was abandoned," and everyone's like, "Oh, so do I." And y'all, you know, come together that was really disparaging against adopted people. I don't know why I made a whingy voice, but they all come together and they use.
This was probably a better move for him than like going straight into just murdering people that look like his mother.
Yeah,
I'd argue anyone out there is struggling, I would advise you go to an adoption group first. This is actually a good move of his.
I was just using it as a narrative.
These moany adoptees.
Yeah. Going like, I've no mammy, boo. So he went to this group. But the reason I'm using that is because the way the story is told, I mean, I know it's coming from Berkowitz, but the way the story is told, he says that he went into this group and he is like, I just found out. He got introduced to all these people and they're like, well, maybe you should look, because there's a lot of us that were adopted and were told that our mothers died in childbirth. And then we actually went looking it up and found out that they weren't dead. And then he went and found out that she wasn't dead, and he came back and he's roaring, crying at these support groups, and they're all like laughing at him. That's what he quoted, laughing at him and saying, that's always the way, man. We all have had that story. Stop, you know, get over it. Get on with your life. And maybe not in a whingy way, I don't know. But he confronted his father and said, is my mother alive? And Nathan, his father, fessed up and said, yeah, his stepfather said, yeah, okay, fuck it. Yeah, we got you off some woman uptown. And gave him all the details, and it turned out her name is Betty Falco, and she was living uptown. Betty, after a few meetings, she disclosed, yeah, I'm your real birth mother, and Betty and her husband Tony had given up the then named Richard David Falco for adoption on the day of his birth, and 3 days later he was found at home. So they lived in New York as well, and it was this whole, like, hidden life that Berkowitz didn't know he had. The guilt was then alleviated. Everything left him. He was like, brilliant, this is, you know, like, my own mother has died, but I have my birth mother, and I may be able to have a family again. And then in some cruel, weird twist of universal irony, finds out that this whole life of living in guilt and shame that he was relieved of, now he met her and he said she was a weak and small woman, that's his quote, that she was sad, she cried when she saw him, she had this squeaky voice, and in interviews they say that when he does impressions of her, he holds his hands over his ears as if to not remember how she sounds, really pathetic and reaching. Yeah. And he found out from Betty that her husband Tony was not his real father. So he thought for a while, I found my real father, Tony Falco, wasn't actually. Yeah. She then confessed, I was having an affair with a man called Joseph Kleinman, who had 3 daughters for another woman and a marriage and all that stuff. So they were having an affair, extramarital affair. And Kleinman said to Betty, I'm not having another baby, especially for my mistress. Give that up for adoption, because there was an abortion at the time, right? So to be like kicked out of the army, to come back, to find out you have a mother, you're like, yay! And then be told, actually, you're a bastard. You don't have a real father. Yeah. Your father didn't want you. And then your mother actually gave you up for adoption because she didn't want you. Like, that is...
Yeah. It also sounds like he'd obviously wanted a certain thing. Yeah, when he met his birth mother, he was obviously expecting some... I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what he was looking for, but obviously the way he describes her sounds like it would have been impossible for her to live up to his expectations.
Yeah.
She had to be this big, you know, obviously, I mean, most people, like, I think, would assume Warbucks. She would have been maybe troubled to have to give up a child and all that.
Yeah.
But he wanted her to just be some big, strong matriarch or something. And it just, it was always doomed for failure, I think that was.
Yeah, well, the roller coaster of emotion, shame, regret, and then relief, and then followed by more regret and shame and all this stuff. Yeah. This could have forced David out into the streets of New York, because then at this point, living in New York, he's living at home, he starts becoming this alley cat Berkowitz. We saw this with the likes of Joseph Fritzl and with Ted Bundy, where they would go out at nighttime, they'd maybe be looking in windows and having an old wank. Like kicking cats and setting little fires and doing kind of weird stuff. And he may have set that whole shoulder hair brunette, I guess, penchant, peccadillo that he had for the victims. So as a young kid, he was full of disgust for himself and he'd roam the streets and do all this stuff as well, like kicking cans and doing whatever. And when he came back from Korea, he started doing it again after finding out about his mother. he has been reported at his bar mitzvah at 13. He said he was disgusted with himself. And he is quoted to say he wasn't a good Jew because he didn't follow the law and he hated his family. So it's just guilt and guilt and guilt and shame and guilt and guilt, right? So after coming from home from the war, he found solace in the adoption group. He found out that none of these fraternal organizations, none of the families that he taught were his, turned out to be real. All the narratives that he'd maybe constructed in his head. You know the way it carried when you're like, you're expecting something, you're hoping for something, and then you hope against hope, and you finally get the realization of it, and it's not what you expected. There is a little bit of disappointment, but there maybe is some solace to it. I've had it a lot in my life.
Yeah, I think, and again, there's two ways you can go with it. And one is to realize that your expectations probably weren't realistic. Also know that you should never overexpect. But I think this sounds like he used to blame himself. It's all guilt, me, I'm the problem. And then it feels like there was a moment where he snapped and suddenly it was someone else's fault and it's time to
Well, age is usually a thing for that. Like I found it in my late teens and early 20s that I did expect an awful lot from the rest of the world. But I also got out and fucking shook my arse. I hustled. I did my shit. But people didn't, you know, and there's lessons that I was learning right into my late 20s and even early 30s. Like there's this new thing where you have to manage your expectations. You have to make sure that you're not setting yourself up for disappointment. But poor old Dahi Berkowitz ended up building up a life for himself that could never have been like.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So in the eternal Son of Sam search for fraternity, for family, for the familiar, he ended up joining a satanic cult that he claims himself at this point. They congregate in New York and they got into some mind-bending drugs. Can you dig it? Like this kind of stuff. And they got into like mad sex parties. And he said himself that he made a blood pact with the devil. And he recalls and recants in his interview, I'm sure you've seen it, that he was shouting for the devil to come and inhabit his body. And like, I am your vessel and take this over. And it sounded like maybe a little bit that he was trying to shift away the blame from killing those people. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think, and also, like you said, there was probably some hallucinogenic time, wasn't it? There was a lot of people. Imagine being around when sort of psychedelics first started knocking around, and you had the West Coast Timothy Leary crew all taking it in nice controlled environments and treating it as a way of contacting your eternal self, whatever. And then you've got, he meets up with a bunch of people who are in a park saying, like, you know, we're going to contact the devil. Yeah. It's all about set and spending. I wouldn't be surprised if he took some acid and in that setting believed that maybe he was inhabited by the devil. I mean, I've done enough hallucinogens in the past to know that you can experience some things that feel very real when you're on them, but you've also got to have the state of mind to afterwards realize what was real, what wasn't, and where did that come from, or
have someone with you at the time who's like set and setting is probably the most important part with hallucinogenics, I've been told. And you have someone who's guiding you through. Like, you're in a park, and people are like, do you know that scene in Dragnet? Do you know that with Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks? And they have all the fire pit, and the virgin and the snake with the fucking pool with the snakes and the lads with the fur on the goatskin chaps and all. Like, that's a fucking crazy place to be taking drugs. At the same time we learned from our Jim Morrison episode that Paris and New York were now the mecca for this new drug that was really coming along called heroin. And there definitely could have been some sorts of heroin. Cocaine was also a big thing. So, like, between the acid culture leaking over from the West, Satanism, heroin and coke, like, he was probably fucking a drug-addled spastic.
I mean, he was in a bit of a melting pot of bad influences. And if somebody is, you know, sort of mentally unstable and looking to do something extreme to take out their guilt, or what they, you know, their ex-guilt on other people, then, you know, this felt like a recipe for disaster, isn't it?
Well, with all of that stuff, like all the satanic stuff all running around his head, this growing desire to do harm, eventually took him over, and he started roaming the streets at night. As a young adult, he's in his late teens, early 20s, and he's roaming the streets. He's imagined killing and hurting women. He says later on that he despised women. He hated women, especially sexy women, or women that were out there doing, dancing was a big thing. He said if he saw women dancing, he'd be like, you're fucking dead, bitch. Because it was this guilt again then with the sexual association. And presumably he wasn't going out with girls. He wasn't getting his fucking knob sucked. So he didn't have those kind of releases. And he ended up being big.
The sexual, he's sexually frustrated. His mum's a mistress, somebody who sees his girls out dancing and enjoying themselves. He's making a lot of mental leaps in his mind that these women are the embodiment of his mum, who he probably wasn't too, he probably didn't have too much respect for, because in his mind she did something wrong. She was probably young and, doe-eyed with a handsome, rich father of three. He can't get his head around that. So it's just these women are now become
lascivious harlots.
Everything that he has caused him to come to this point, they are it. They embody it.
Shit crack. Well, he promised, after learning about his other family and learning about his other half-sisters, he met some of them and their kids, and he went, okay, look, I promise I'm not going to kill them or anyone in my family or my real mother. But what I will do now is turn my anger outwards and go and kill some randomers. So he began getting violent, and he attempted his first murder on Christmas Eve in 1975 when he used a hunting knife to try and stab two women. Michelle Foreman was the only one identified of the two, and she said that her winter coat saved her life when Berkowitz tried to stab her. He couldn't get around, and she wrapped a knife around with one of the sleeves or one of the flaps on the side of the coat. And it was only later on, when she was given the photo fit, which ended up being shite, to the cops, that she was saying, like, he came at me, he tried to stab me, he couldn't get me, and he slashed the other girl. And nobody knew that this was Berkowitz at the time, but he confessed to that crime later on as his first kind of dalliance with murder. And I think this was probably the point when he decided, I'm not going to use a knife, I'm probably going to use a gun. And being a marksman from the army, that he was well used to firearms. So he was living at home. He was living in his father Nathan's house. They were sharing a house. And he said he was being kept awake by barking dogs. So he relocated, got a new place, a new apartment in Yonkers in New York. And this is the center of where he did all of his bad stuff. And he said he was kept up at night often by barking dogs. Now,
It sounds like,
That hadn't been refuted, but maybe that goes along with the whole Son of Sam thing where the dogs
were. It's weird that he had that issue with his dad's and then he's had it here. It's a bit of a coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah.
I feel like maybe it was one of them and he's just built the... No, he's trying, again, like you said earlier, he's trying to defer blame onto something else.
A lot of these bits of information are coming from interviews with him himself, so he gets to write his own story. So it seems like, do we believe him? He had insomnia, obviously. He used to spend his nights as a taxi driver and his days as a post office worker. And he said sometimes at night, because he was, quote unquote, kept up by the dogs, he just walked the streets at night and he couldn't sleep. Sometimes he drove the taxi down to the beach and he'd try and sleep in the car on the beach. I think he was suffering from some sort of a mental disorder that kept him
anxiety.
And that further led into bad behavior, because lack of sleep is obviously going to be detrimental to your physical and mental health.
Definitely. And have you ever seen the Seinfeld episode, isn't there, when is it George
Costanza? Who
is it, somebody starts working in the mailroom or the post office, and he gets given, Son of Sam's post sack. I think there's an episode.
Oh, really?
I'm sure there is. I'll have to check. But it's referenced, yeah.
Jesus. Is that the thing where you get, going postal? That's obviously somebody else. Know, that's another murderer.
But yeah, somebody definitely. Else murdered, But I'm sure it's referenced in Seinfeld in quite a funny way.
Well, he ended up trying to go get this gun to try and shoot all these people, because having a knife was a load of shite. So he got an old army buddy to bring a gun shopping uptown, and he got this sketchy Bulldog 44 caliber pistol, which wasn't a super common gun. It wasn't any Smith & Wesson or anything that was all around. And he used this in all of these shootings, and he got the nickname the 44 caliber killer until the time he identified himself as the son of Sam. So the first shooting was in the Bronx, and Donna Lauria, 18, and her friend Jolie Valenti, 18, were sitting in their car after a disco, and Berkowitz rolled past in the car, saw the two of them sitting there, drove past, went, pulled in a couple of blocks ahead, walked back, and then just opened fire in through the window. Now,
Did one get shot in the leg?
Jody Valenti got shot in the leg, and Donna Lauria died. And he said this was the thing that made him. He stood there frozen, and he had, in his own words, not a sexual orgasm, but a mental one. And he stared there until Valenti then slammed on the horn, started beeping for people, screaming for people to come down. And Berkowitz ran off to the car. And then Lauria's dad came down, and he, like, you know, the Pieta, you know, like holding his dying daughter in his arms, like screaming for the cops and all this stuff. And this was a scene that Berkowitz said he replayed over and over in his head. I don't know if he got sexual gratification or satisfaction from it. Like, it's something like to just roll up on two girls in a car and just open fire for no reason.
Yeah. That's the scariest thing, I suppose, is that, you know, when they tell that story to the police and when that gets around, the fact that's why I think it became such a terrifying thing for locals, in that there was no provocation, nothing. It was, they didn't know anything about any trend of who it could be. Anyone sitting in a car. I just watched a documentary where they interviewed just people living in the area, and they all said, I no longer sit in my car.
Yeah.
No, they're afraid to wait outside a friend's house. So that it's such a simple thing that it must have just been, would have gotten everyone.
Well, Carol De Niro
changed people's behavior.
Yeah, changed the whole city's behavior. Carol De Niro was 20, and Rosemary Keenan, who was 18, were the next victims in October 1976. And that was the first set of a stream of bungled murder attempts that Berkowitz tried to perpetuate. He wasn't fully confident.
This guy got shot in the head, didn't he?
Yeah, he got shot in the head. And he ended up with a plate in his head.
Yeah, but he still managed to drive off. I've seen interviews with this guy. He's pretty cool, man. He's pretty it's pretty matter of fact about it. Yeah. Just like he said, he didn't know he'd been shot. He thought somebody had just smashed the window, so he just knuckled down, drove off, and then realized he'd been shot in the head. Like 10 minutes later.
Some just hard New York lad going, yo, I was just driving my car, and then this fat Jewish guy rolled up, shot me. I was like, yo, whatever, out. Got a fucking plate in his head. Rosemary Keenan got a couple of shots to the body and one to the leg. And I think maybe Berkowitz wasn't fully confident in what he was doing. Even though he's a marksman, he was going up and shooting people in cars, right? So when he was shooting, the bullets were going through metal, going through glass, and then through flesh and then through bone. So they were obviously smashing into tiny bits, so they couldn't be positively identified as 44 caliber, and definitely not being able to match to the same gun, because you know the way you have to have the barrel stuff and it has the scrapes along the side. We've seen the CSI, how it works. Yeah. So the next one...
Batman.
3D job.
Yeah, but Donna DeMasi... That's such an impossible thing.
Yeah, it's like putting a mobile phone in the building and then it goes, boom, and scans the whole building. Could it do that? Maybe they can. But Donna DeMasi was 16 years of age, and Joanne Lomino, who was 18, sitting on the front porch. This is out of character for him. Sitting on the front porch when a man in army fatigues walked up and asked for directions in a weird, high-pitched voice. And just before he finished asking, they looked over and he pulled out a revolver and then just sprayed the whole barrel into the house and into the girls. Now, he hit DeMasi in the neck. She didn't die. And he hit Lomino in the back and in the lower back. And she didn't die, but Lomino was paralyzed from the waist down from then on. So this was like a further disappointment for Berkowitz. He was going out in these shootings, doing this stuff, and still not killing people. He still wasn't getting the thing that he wanted or needed. Yeah. And then finally, Virginia Voskhodishyan, who was a 19-year-old Bulgarian student who had just recently got U.S. citizenship, and she was studying at Columbia University, was walking home, and she had her school books. And he jumped out and at point blank held the gun up to her face, and she went, and put the books up, and he shot her through the books into the head. But because it hit the books first, the bullet retained its shape. And it was this point that they were able to identify it's coming from a 44 gun. And at a press conference on the 10th of March in 1977, the NYPD said it's lads shooting lads with a 44 caliber gun, and they called him the 44 caliber killer that day.
I also think there was, and from this documentary I saw, there was, I think this was one of the ones where somebody got a good look at him. Like, I think a witness saw him about 3 minutes later, like somebody, they saw somebody looking quite nervy and running away from the scene, and they caught a good sight of him. And I think the EFIT from this one was actually starting to, they were starting to see a trend in some of them as well.
More accurate. There was a whole lot of other ones at the time, but I think those ones were the most important because it was like, it went from two girls in a car to a couple like shifting, and then they ended up getting a load of bullets, to him coming out in the open, you know, in army fatigues, like he's wearing a uniform, something that could be identified, to then you know, attacking a girl at point blank on her own with no care at all. So it seems he's getting braver and braver as it goes along, and the braver he got and the closer he got to the victim, the easier it was for him to identify him, you know.
So yeah, so after he killed what was her name, the Virginia, the student, that's when people fully started freaking out, I think. So from what I've got it here, but women started changing their haircut because they were convinced it was brunettes that were getting short, shoulder length brunettes. So everyone started dyeing their hair blonde, cutting it short. And this is when I think they got their first letter. So he left a note on a car addressed to the police. And it was the first time they knew that they were all linked. There was actually, on the documentary I saw, there was a suspicion they were linked, but no one had actually confidently said, right, trace them right through. And then he sent this letter. I've got it here, actually. I'll read this one. This was the first one, and it is creepy. It says, I am deeply hurt by your calling me a woman hater. I'm not, but I am a monster. I am the son of Sam. I am a little brat. When Father Sam gets drunk, he gets mean. He beats his family. Sometimes he ties me up to the back of the house. Other times he locks me in the garage. Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill, commands Father Sam. Behind our house, some rest. Mostly young, raped and slaughtered. Their blood drained. Just bones now. Papa Sam keeps me locked in the attic too. I can't get out, but I look out the attic window and watch the world go by. I feel like an outsider. I'm on a different wavelength than everybody else, programmed to kill. However, to stop me, you must kill me. Attention, all police, shoot me first. Shoot to kill or else. Keep out of my way or you will die. Papa Sam is old now. He needs some blood to preserve his youth. He has had too many heart attacks. Too many heart attacks. Me hoot, it hurts, sonny boy. I miss my pretty princess most of all. She's resting in our lady's house, but I'll see her soon. I am the monster, Beelzebub, the chubby behemoth. I love to hunt, prowling the streets, looking for fair game, tasty meat. The women of Queens are the prettiest of all. I must be the water they drink. I live for the hunt, my life. Blood for Papa. Mr. Borelli, sir, I don't want to kill anymore. No, sir, no more, but I must honour thy father. I want to make love to the world. I love people. I don't belong on earth. Return me to Yahoos, to the people of Queens. I love you. And I want to wish you all a happy Easter. May God bless you in this life and the next. For now, I say goodbye and good night. Police, let me haunt you with these words. I'll be back. I'll be back to be interpreted. Bang, 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 bang. Ugh, yours in murder, Mr. Monster. That is quite something, isn't it?
He started off going like, I'm a fucking bastard, I'm going to kill you, and have a happy Easter, and mind yourselves, and I'll see you around Christmas.
I think the sort of the actual, obviously you think somebody's mad if they go around shooting people. When you read that, I think it was the first time you think this guy is absolutely insane.
You see that there's a kind of a printed letter, like he does this capital letter. It's fucking bananas. The letters look like a crazy person, but it's like capital letter printed handwritten note, and he left it on the car after he murdered Alexander Aesu and Valentina Suriani. And the police, imagine finding this and going, oh, we have a fucking fruit and nutcase on our fucking hands here. Like, especially when the whole 16 million people in New York are freaking out, women dyeing their hair. The streets are empty most nights because no one wants to be out around it. Like, He also sent another letter to a Daily News columnist, Jimmy Breslin, and the envelope was marked Blood and Family, Darkness and Death, Absolute Depravity, and 44 Caliber. And he wrote, Hello from the gutters of New York City, which are filled with dog manure, vomit, stale wine, urine, and blood. Hello from the sewers of New York City, which swallow up these delicacies when they're washed away by the sweeper trucks. Hello from the cracks in the sidewalks of NYC, and from the ants that dwell in the cracks and feed in the dry blood of the dead that settled into them. I'm just dropping you a line to let you know I appreciate your interest in those recent and horrendous 44 caliber killings. I also want to tell you I read your column daily, and I find it quite informative. Tell me, Jim, what will you have for July 29th? You can forget about me if you like. I don't care for the publicity. However, you must not forget Donna Laria, and you cannot let the people forget her either. She was a very, very sweet girl, but Sam's a thirsty lad, and he won't let me stop killing until he gets his fill of blood. Mr. Breslin, sir, don't think that because you haven't heard from me for a while that I went to sleep. No. Rather, I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest. Anxious to please Sam. I love my work. Now, the void has been filled. Perhaps we shall meet face to face someday, or perhaps I will be blown away by the cops with smoking 38s. Whatever, if I shall be fortunate enough to meet you, I will tell you all about Sam, and I'll introduce you to him. His name is Sam the Terrible. Not knowing what the future holds, I shall say farewell, and I will see you at the next job. Or should I say, you will see me my handiwork at my next job. Remember Miss Laria, thank you. In her blood, from the gutter, Sam's creation, 44. Here are some names to help you along. Forward them to the inspector for use by NCIC. The Duke of Death, the Wicked King Wicker, the 22 Disciples of Hell, John Wheaties, rapist and suffocator of young girls. P.S. Inform all the detectives working the slaying to remain. Please inform all the detectives working the case that I wish them the best of luck. Keep them digging. Drive them on. Think positive. Get off your butts. Knock on coffins, etc. Upon my capture, I promise to buy all the guys working the case a new pair of shoes if I can get up the money. Love, Son of Sam. Like that. That is the craziest thing ever. Because that's sent to a fucking journalist telling them, like, on the 29th, I'm going to commit some murders. Don't forget your Juan Laria. Here's a load of cool nicknames that I've given myself that you can use in the paper.
And then, self-name nicknames is always a bad sign. That's always just, that's, an ego's going crazy.
I'm the Duke of Death. That's a fucking shit one, man.
That thing where he just says, I read your column daily. It sounds like he's starting like an actual, just, you know, the letters you get in the local paper.
Yeah.
I read your column daily.
It's like an application for an internship. It's like, I love your work. And if you don't give me a job, I'm going to kill a lot of people on the 29th.
It's mad. Some of their nicknames. Yeah. Mental. John Wheaties.
John Wheaties, imagine. At this point, Berkowitz is a household name. They thought he was hiding around every corner, and the police were so desperate to find him. I saw in a documentary that they were even watching episodes of Starsky and Hutch, because there was a similar storyline in a Starsky and Hutch episode. And they were like, maybe this guy is copying that thing. So let's fast forward to the end and see what happens. And we just do that and solve the case. I don't know. I mean, they must have been really desperate, because there was no way of getting him. And I couldn't see how this guy is so good that he would not leave any DNA or any of this kind of stuff, you know, like when watching Mindhunter. Did you ever watch that on Netflix, where they're talking trying to find Ed Kemper, trying to talk about finding Ted Bundy, to talk about Richard Speck. Like, there's all these murderers, and there's a guy in the FBI who's trying to develop this, I guess, personality modeling to try and find criminals. And this stuff was in its infancy, but they were trying to do this, like looking through his letters and looking through all this stuff. But the reason he was known as the Son of Sam, and the thing that I thought for years, was the fact that he thought his neighbor Sam Carr was the devil, and his dog, who was possessed by a demon, was giving him messages telepathically. So he shot the dog after a lengthy exchange of like threatening letters between Carr. And then the thing that got him caught, and this is so simple, and the reason that he got caught, I think, is because he really, really wanted to. He was fed up with killing, and he just wanted to cash it in. So these letters that were sent to Carr were attached to a case after Berkowitz got a parking ticket for parking in front of a fire hydrant, and his bright yellow Ford Galaxy, which is fairly conspicuous, was easily traced when they took the license plate. They matched it to the address. They looked at any reports of police that had to do with that address, and found out that he was sending threatening letters. Then they went and interviewed the neighbor, and the neighbor's like, that guy's fucking crazy. So they sent the police over, and they saw Berkowitz coming out of his house with a little brown paper bag unbeknownst to the police, that had the fucking gun in it, and he was out on another shooting spree for the night. And the police goes, "Freeze, are you David Berkowitz?" And he's like, "Ah, shite, you got me." And the cop is like, "What? Who have I got?" He's like, "Son of Sam. I'm Son of Sam. You got me? Oh, shit, did you not? Oh, shit." Like, he just gave himself up super easy.
Yeah. Well, that suggests that he definitely was done and wanted to be caught.
I think that he wanted to be caught from the very start, and that's why he's given out, like, after four or five murders, or at least attempts, he was, like, putting out letters going, catch me, like.
Well, do you think that's why some of the attempts felt, and this is a horrible way to describe a shooting of anyone, but they felt a bit half-hearted almost.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's insensitive to say that, because obviously he did kill some people, but, you know, like, shoot two people at point blank range who were sitting on a porch, you know, that is, if he's a trained army marksman, you know, it stinks of panic, and it almost like he was obsessed with doing it, but actually didn't want it to work. I don't know.
Maybe he wanted to get the attention for being a serial murderer, but just not do any of the murders. And after after seven people injured, he was like, maybe I just have to start killing people. And then he started successfully killing them. And then they still couldn't catch him. So then he's dropping letters. And then the minute a cop goes by him, he's like, you have me now.
Yeah.
Do you know?
It does feel of attention seeking, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I said it. Should have done stand-up. Stand-up comedy was the way out, man.
That's it. You get away with it. So anyway, to wrap it up, the media frenzy that fell on Berkowitz at the time was immense, and he seemed to really enjoy it. He couldn't stop smiling after his arrest, and he was put in Attica, which was a notorious prison at the time for some riots and prisoner maltreatment, I guess. They were calling for his death. The people of New York were like, kill this lad. There's no death penalty in New York, and they were wanting his execution. He killed six people, brutally injured seven, and Robert Violante was shot in the head, and he was blinded in both eyes, and his girlfriend was killed. And his family were speaking on the documentary I watched, and his mom was like, "That guy, they should absolutely execute him. He's a disgrace, a disgusting human being." And all of the things that Berkowitz was saying about himself, like, "I'm disgusting, I'm a waste of space, I'm a piece of shit, I'm not worth anything, I'm a bastard." Like, he heard that echoed back from the world. And it seemed to delight him somehow, because he was smiling and he was gleefully recanting these disgusting details of these murders, so much so that it was undeniable that it was him, because only he would know the details.
And the police
were like, "Yeah, you're the only one." You know the way they do that.
Yeah, that's weird. So, yeah, maybe it's like he was desperate for the, you know, he always thought he was a monster and a bastard, and hearing it, he actually sort of almost wanted to just prove it for finally that it, you know.
Oh, just get acknowledgement. Like, that's what a lot of those guys do. You know, you see the murderers and they're like, why don't you catch me, Mr. Copper? Like, and leaving clues. Like, Zodiac was leaving notes and still didn't get caught.
Yeah.
You know, Ted Bundy, the same. Like, loads of these guys leaving stuff behind to go, catch me, please. Like, I want, not only do I want the gratification of killing them, but I want the glory as well. So, after a couple of years.
Have you followed his sort of progress since you've been in prison?
I haven't.
Because I know I watched some clips of him in the 90s. So he basically, obviously he sort of quite, he owned it a bit when he first was sentenced.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he was still banging on about being a monster and all that. But in the 90s, I saw an interview with him where he went back to saying it's a satanic cult. And actually he claimed that he wasn't responsible for all the murders and it was a group thing. You know, it was part of a much bigger.
He said that there was almost immediately, like a year after he was arrested, the whole kind of dog is a demon and told me how to do it fell apart. So he confessed it wasn't a dog, and he pled guilty in court and said, like, put me away forever because I'm afraid I'm going to kill again. And then he made up some, then later on in the 80s, he made up some other story. And in the 90s, there's interviews you can watch where he does say, yeah, it was part of a cult, and that I only committed three of the murders, and the rest of them and the shootings were done by other people in the cult as initiation rites. Like you were saying earlier on, that it could actually be linked to like Zodiac, and the Zodiac killer is not just one person. It's like
that's what I heard on one of the theories, yeah. And also Manson, it's like some of them linked it back to Manson as well.
But yeah, because Manson was alive this whole time, maybe giving orders from inside. Yeah. And
that's one of the theories. But I mean, it's not, that's just, you have an idea. But
but with a lad like this, he's totally full of shit, man. Down. He's full of shit, Carrie.
That's
like,
the thing.
You can, everything he's ever said can be, you know, he's gone back on it either himself or it can be disproven through physical evidence. So what the fuck?
And I'll tell you the reason I definitely think it's all bollocks is because he's now become a full-on born-again Christian. And he's gone full circle and just said he was just a troubled, you know, bad young person looking for attention and all that. And he's now, you know, he's got like a website where he gives advice to young people how to not fall down into, like, you know, into bad habits. So, you know, I think you had some things that were slightly worse than bad habits, mate. But yeah, he's really trying to, he's really reinvented himself. He's not, like, I don't know if he's looking for parole or anything. I think he knows he's there for life. And
yeah, he's in, yeah. He's serving 13, 25 to life consecutive sentences back to back.
Yep.
And when he comes up for parole, he gets told, yeah, okay, we'll take 15 years off that sentence. And now you start the next one. So he's told, like, I'll never be out of jail. But some of the shit that he's done since being in there has gotten more notoriety than the murders themselves. Like, he's come out every so often saying, like, same with Charlie Manson. Like, you come out with some mad shit. You do an interview with Diane Sawyer, or you call in, like, you know, fucking Louis Theroux, and, you know, you do your documentary. He once claimed that the Hall and Oates song Rich Girl motivated him to kill. that it was telling people, like, you know, you're a rich girl, but you're gone too far, and you know you shouldn't be taking the old man's money, you should earn it yourself. And he was killing all these girls. Did you know that, you were saying he was a little bit of an arsonist, he set 1400 fires in New York before he turned to murder. That's a lot of fires.
I did know that. That's a load of fires.
That was a,
I mean, what
of
a scale.
Yeah.
We're talking, I mean, he could be saying 1400 and he could be including, like, lighting a match as one of those.
Well, he was, yeah, I guess, lighting a paper and throwing it in a bin. Yeah. But it was a whole thing that, like, the police were going, well, let's go through your crimes. And he said, I did this, and they marked it off as reports of all these crimes. So it's up to 1400. And that's reported stuff. Yeah, imagine that. The fact that he was killing people in cars, he came out then with this, as he turned Christian, he came out with this moral thing of, I was doing the world a favor. I was killing these couples in cars who were going to have unprotected sex and end up with bastard children, and I didn't want another child to be born like me. It's unwanted and given up for adoption. And I'm sure Roe v. Wade and the legalization of abortion and stuff kind of spurred him on to try and make up that narrative. And there's a report as well of him freaking out in court where he was being sentenced. Like, there was another hearing and the families of his victims were there, and he got up and he started screaming and climbing over the back bench, like climbing over the thing, screaming at the families, going, I'd do it all again if I had the chance, and if you ever get near me, I'll fucking kill all ye as well. And you can only imagine, like, how difficult that is for the families. What the fuck, like, also the fact that he asked to be put away for life. He's like, put me away forever.
Yeah, it's weird because you can't work out if he's just fully insane or is a bit of an egotist and was acting up a bit and trying to build his character even more there.
Well, the building of his character and this whole kind of, like, follow me on Instagram mentality, what is Ash Son of Sam, by the way. If you see what he did, he manipulated the media. And I think for the first time since Manson, because they didn't really give Manson a lot of press because it was late 60s. This is now 80s. You're talking about, like, insatiable news, kind of perpetual news feed. They wanted stuff all the time. So they brought in these laws called Sam's Laws, which restricted the profits able to be made by a perpetrator of a crime for selling their story to the likes of 60 Minutes or whatever. So you couldn't be remunerated for making up stories, because this cunt was such a liar and such a story maker that they went, every time the television comes in here, you get a few bob. So you're not allowed to profit from selling the rights to your story.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, a world changer, that they're not allowed to have this profiteering, or because you just change your story then and you can resell it again.
Yeah. And what happens with the money? Are they allowed to pass it to family members or friends? Or
I don't think anyone from the estate is allowed to profiteer from the story. That it can be like done for journalism or whatever, but not for any of these.
But before that law, could somebody theoretically have profited, say, by selling their story as a serial killer and then giving the money to their own family?
Yeah, sure.
So theoretically, you could treat it as a business.
I mean, yeah, it's a speculative. I mean, you have to really do well for people to be popular. It's not like releasing a podcast or something like, geez, I hope this does well. No.
Yeah, I'm just saying before that, it could have theoretically by one person who wanted to set their family up quite
sure,
well.
Look at how much money Serial made. If you were working for This American Life and you're like, I wonder if I create a 10-part podcast where I turn out to be the murderer at the end. Like, that's the next thing. That's the thing that either make or break podcasting. But it's such a weird story. Like, what, like, to finish up, like, what do you think then after learning all that stuff? We went through this whole thing this week, you and me, and now we've found out he's a fucking crazy cunt who was mad for the attention. He's a liar.
I think it is classic. You know, again, this is somebody who's, I've probably read a handful of psychology books over the years. I've did therapy for a period of my life. Yeah, I know a little bit about it, but it just stinks of child feels like never got enough attention, was abandoned by any, you know, powerful person that should have been there when they were a child, grew up with this desperate need for attention and to be not even loved, but to be wanted or just to be known and to be, you know, important.
Yeah.
And then with the sort of, you know, mental health problems that I'm sure arose from his childhood and teens, and they started, you know, sort of coming out in little acts of violence. I think it was just, that was the natural progression for him, feeling that he needed to do something big so that people would recognize him.
Did you see the videos of his father when they asked, like, did you ever expect your son to be that? What did you do when you found out? And he said, I cried. And he broke down into mad tears.
Stayed with him, didn't he? Right up until his death. Stayed never abandoned him. You know, ironically, it's sort of after that, his dad, you know, clearly is actually probably much more. So that's the thing we had when we got his side of the story, but his adopted dad actually was a much better dad than he pretends in his, you know, how he talks about him. And
maybe Berkowitz is giving the bash.
He's just trying to keep a family, you know. Somebody who's got abandonment issues will see that worse than somebody who just thinks their dad's out making a few coin.
Do you think that the dad could have done anything to stop that at some point, seeing that he's setting a load of fires and he's killing the fucking family parakeet? Do you think that he could have went in and said, look, come on, to fuck, what are you doing? Like, they brought him to a psychologist.
Yeah.
And the psychologist was like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Well, that's the problem, isn't it? It's also, we don't know, psychology back then and therapy was probably very different to it is now. We probably had different, like, checklists of, right, he's killed a parakeet. You know, now I would say if somebody's killing animals in their teens, we know that has got, you know, that's a really bad sign. Whereas back then, it's probably just, you know, they might have been a little bit more naive in their psychological diagnosis.
Do you think it was a part of the thing of, like, he was adopted and maybe we got a broken one and I don't want to admit that, so I'm just going to hang on and see and hope he's okay? Like, if it was his own child, maybe he would have been a bit harsher, or if he had had some connection with him as a child, maybe he didn't want to meddle.
You wouldn't want to even contemplate putting him into care or anything like that, because I imagine they're thinking of the abandonment issues that would cause as well. They didn't realise that maybe the damage was already done.
Yeah. And then do you think about the letters and stuff? We're getting kind of, there's no off the fence really in the true crime, so it's just finding out how you feel about the end of it. Like, you think, like you said, the false murders at the start or the failed ones at the start were maybe him not wanting to follow through, and then towards the end he's like, fuck, if I want to get attention, I'm going to have to actually kill some fuckers. And then he threw out some letters. Like, was this a desperate ploy, or?
I think he was just a bit of a dick who wanted attention, and it escalated and he ended up, I don't know, it felt like the early ones were very, for some of these marksmen to, you know, just be that thoughtless with the aim, I think.
Maybe he was super thoughtful because they hit someone in the neck and the spine instead of in the face or the heart. Statistically, is probably way more difficult to miss.
I suppose. I don't know. I just feel like it wasn't. He didn't have that cold commitment to every shot. It feels like a panicked, desperate need to do it rather than a calculated decision making, process.
Yeah, maybe so. And he's still alive. So if you got a chance to ask him something, he was at the end of last year, he was moved to a medical facility because he was suffering from a heart attack. And some of the last public quotes he made were, my killing spree was a break from reality and I thought I was doing something to appease the devil. I am sorry for it. There hasn't been any public statement from him since. He's still alive. What would you ask him if you got a chance?
I mean, I'd probably ask about the letters. I think I'd ask him, was he conscious when he was writing them that they sounded insane, or was that genuinely what he was thinking? That was the exact wording of what he wanted to write, or was there a sort of bit of playing up to it?
Do you give some credence to the fact that it might have been like a conglomeration of the satanic cult? Because he didn't seem like... He was smart. He was a smart dude. But the stuff that was in those letters are too mental to just be one guy like going, the Duke of Death and all these kind of things. It seems like it could have been written by committee and people were like, oh, say this, that sounds weird. And he's writing them like... Do you think
why
there was any
he
credence to...
Now, like, saying he's sorry now, repenting and becoming a Christian, why would he not then give names and stuff of people that were involved? I think he's gone back on that whole thing in the 90s of saying it was a group and he didn't do them all. He's now accepting full responsibility for them.
Maybe because they came to him and said, like, we'll make your life worse.
Yeah, maybe. I think he was a solo, sad, messed up guy who did horrible things because he was looking for attention and snapped and just did,
didn't get enough
and
love.
And he didn't get enough love, but also, that's no excuse. And now he's rightly sort of paying the price.
Yeah. It's a unilateral fact, man. The kids that don't get hugged enough or get hugged too much seem to end up in this type of nefarious situation. So hug your kids out there, guys.
Yeah.
Let them know that you love them.
Not too much.
For fuck's sake. But not too much. Yeah.
Ration one a day.
Daily hug time, Matthew. But... that's it, man. That's it for the end of Son of Sam. I'm going to put up just loads of extra stuff that is just too murky and long-winded to go through. But I just like to look into the past life and just go, like, why is he doing this thing? If you want to find out more about the murders, there's Summer Sam. That's a really good atmospheric kind of depiction of what was going on at the time. There's like little tidbits and other... Like, all of his interviews are all available on YouTube. So I put a load of those up in the BitChute channel. So if you want to get in contact with the show, anything we're doing on the show, or you want to get, ask some questions or fill in some gaps, tell me something that I've done wrong, info@thoseconspiracyguys is the email. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Reddit, Pinterest, anything that has a social media, we have it. T Conspiracy Guys or Those Conspiracy Guys, search conspiracy and we should show up. We also have a website, thoseconspiracyguys.com, and the lifeblood of the show, Patreon. So patreon.com/thoseconspiracyguys. You guys over there, keeping the lights on and keeping me in a full-time job doing these podcasts. You will also be able to get to watch this if you're watching this on YouTube in the future. You can watch these live as I make them if you are a Patreon. We're streaming right now exclusively to patreon.com, and I will be releasing this video as I release the episode. So going on into the future, for the next few months, I'm recording all of season 7 and all the true crimes before we head away for our America trip for TCG TV. So I'm going to America for 9 months to make 12 documentaries and a whole bunch of daily vlogs for the 9 months that we're there. And you can find out more about that on gofundme.com/TCGTV. And you can get, a fiver, roll it up into a ball, throw it up the internet, and help me get to go to America to make more stuff for you to watch with your eyes. So all that leaves me to do is say thanks very much to Carl Donnelly for joining me. Thanks, Carl, for talking about some
sound. Cheers, mate. What's that? It's fun.
Good crack. We can find you all of the social medias as well. Carl Donnelly, DONNELLY. And yes. You have Carol Donnelly at .co.uk. Go and see him at a plethora of UK and Irish comedy clubs. Just keep an eye out for him and keep your eye on his Twitter for notifications of those. Thanks so much, mate, for joining me, man.
No, it's really, really fun. I mean, it's obviously quite harrowing as well at times.
Oh, yeah, but like...
interesting. I mean, it's interesting. Like, it's not, you know, I'm a firm believer there's no such thing as just good people, bad people. I think there's reasons for everything. You know, we've all done bad things. And it doesn't mean I think there's, you know, I'm not justifying anyone doing anything bad, but I think there is always a root cause.
For sure. Hug your kids, everybody. That's it for those conspiracy guys for this time. My name is Gordo.
Carl.
And we'll see you again next time. Bye.
Cheers, mate.